This episode of the Troxel Podcast is made possible with support from ArcIT. Are you tired of standard IT services that miss the mark? Choose ArcIT for specialized, proactive IT management, BIM support, and robust data security tailored for architects. Whether you're a team of 10 or a growing firm of 50+, ArcIT understands the architecture industry and will empower your unique creative vision to enable you to do your best work. Embrace a technology team that enhances, not hinders, your design process. Visit getarcit.com for your free IT assessment and start transforming your firm and your tech experience today. That's getarcit.com. Welcome to the Troxel Podcast. I'm Evan Troxel. I have a little podcast business here before I introduce my guests. If you're enjoying these episodes, please subscribe to Troxel on YouTube and the audio podcast on your preferred platform. Your subscription is incredibly valuable in supporting my efforts. So full transparency here, subscriber numbers directly influence my ability to attract better sponsors and higher profile guests. A large audience makes this podcast more appealing to them, which in turn brings more value to you and your listening experience. So if you haven't subscribed, I encourage you to do so. It is free and a great way to support Troxel. And remember, subscribing on YouTube and in your favorite audio podcast app is equally important. Besides subscribing, there are two more ways you can support the show. You can now make a one-time donation at trxl.co/donate. or consider becoming a member. To learn more about the perks of membership and to join, simply click on one of the subscribe buttons on trxl.co. Your support is crucial for the sustainability of this show, and I deeply appreciate it. All right, this episode is a continuation of the last one with Phil Reed. So if you skip that one, you might want to go back and listen because this picks up right where we left off. Also, this is the perfect time to remind you that Phil and I recorded this in person in the United Lounge of the Denver Airport, which makes it a little more special in my mind. And when you hear the dishes clanking in the background, that's why. Today, we kick things off talking about the upcoming 2024 AEC Acoustics Best Practice Roundtables, which is a conference for subject matter experts, solutions providers, and decision makers in the built environment. It will be held at Lake Swan Camp in Melrose, Florida at the end of April. The event focuses on discussions without distractions, and the best part of every technology conference, I think we could probably all agree, is the conversations after the presentations. So that's all they are. There are a few roundtables that have already been announced on the website, and I'm happy to announce that I'll be there, and I'll be leading one of the roundtables too. I've been told that accommodations at Lake Swan Camp are modest and comfortable, and the camp offers opportunities for a lot of really cool outdoor activities. Meals will be catered by Chef Charles Samail, which I can guarantee will not be considered like any camp food you've ever had in any way, and there will be up to 4 roundtable sessions per day with open afternoon discussions and informal evening gatherings. I really can't wait to visit Florida for the first time and to meet up with a small group of like-purposed people in AEC tech. I've included 2 links in the show notes for this event, one for you to find out more about it and one to register. In this conversation, we also talk about the importance of saying no to maintain personal freedom and creativity, how modern pressures for efficiency and productivity can stifle creativity and personal satisfaction, the impact of technology and media on our ability to enjoy and appreciate music and art, how saying no to certain opportunities can open doors to more fulfilling and personally meaningful experiences, and a whole lot more. So once again, this was a fantastic conversation, and without further ado, I bring you part 2 of my conversation with Phil Reed. Well, let's kick this second part off after our little break there. Yeah. Talk about these retreats. Is that what, how do you characterize them?
Another accident, right? It's like we're coming out of, well, actually, we started to go into pandemic. And what I realized, being curious, observant, there's a lot of stressed out people in the AEC space. They've worked themselves up to a position. Their kids are getting older. They're just incredibly stressed out, and they can't leave their job at that point because they probably have a very nice house, very nice. They have all these their trappings in a way.
Yeah.
And they're just stressed out with life changes at that point.
And you alluded to it earlier when you talked about you were put in that position when you went to work at this firm, that all of a sudden you had to deal with the people side.
Yeah.
You weren't equipped necessarily, or you didn't feel equipped to deal with that part of it. You were much more technically oriented. I think and you've said this yourself, it's the same for the kind of people that you want to come to these, because they need to hear that from other people. How have they solved it? What are they dealing with? Are you feeling like this too?
It was an existential transition from the predictable part of dealing with technology to the unpredictable part of managing kind of people and all of that.
Yeah.
And I didn't have I could be friendly enough, but I didn't have that skill set, that soft skill set. And yeah. I started engaging with a coach probably in late 2019.
For this specific?
For my specific kind of edification.
Okay.
And it was also kind of in the back of my mind apparent to me that there was a dozen guys talking to me about the stuff that I was talking to the same coach about. It's like your life is changing and the kids are growing up. Like, why am I still grinding? How do I start to decompress?
How do I work less?
Yeah.
A lot of people have felt that.
And it just finally occurred to me probably in the spring of 2020, I'm talking to 10 people about what I'm talking to you about.
Yeah.
We should just get together somewhere. And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, first of all, I don't want to meet in a hotel. I want to go somewhere, you know, like amid nature. And as we started to describe it, he was like, oh, an unconference, I'm in. So the first year, it's more of a leadership retreat. It's for people who have the accidental thing that happens is we're subject matter experts and we're really good at what we do. We love what we do. And we get elevated because of what we do to sort of manage people that do that thing. And then we find out we're not necessarily good at managing people. And we're not good at that emotional investment to manage people. And so how do we get better at that? And I think ultimately for me, as I mentioned, you really can't, you can control technology, but you can't control people.
Mm.
And so they're unpredictable in that way. Even when technology is unpredictable, you sort of wrangle it out, figure out why the crash is occurring or why something's breaking Revit. But with people, it's not mechanical.
Debugging.
Oh man, just people that show up 2 minutes late to a meeting.
Yeah.
How crazy that makes me. And other people are like, oh yeah, I'm here. I'm on time. You know, so the expectation now for myself that I have to remind myself is, do I have a false expectation when I start to feel myself getting stressed? What's the false expectation?
Mm.
And ultimately I can only control how I respond to what I can't control.
Mm.
So, Randy Ben is the facilitator. And so we organized very ad hoc, let's get together and talk for 3 days about leadership stresses and self-expectations and where you want to get to. And so that was the fall of 2020. And we just had this year, fall of 2023, that would have been our fourth year. And it's about how you show up. Because I think if you bring that stress into the room, it's going to shut down the conversation. And it's taken a while to get there, and I still have a ways to go. But I find that a lot of times my stress was elevated because I thought I knew why something was broken, and I was getting frustrated by that. And usually what happens is when I have more information, I go, oh, that's what's going on? Oh, okay, well, that's all. We'll figure that out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then time and time again, if you'll just wait and get the information, then you're like, oh, that's all it is? But getting to that point where you cannot, where you don't bit flip and just get frustrated right away,
right?
Because something else has gone sideways. So managing my own set of unrealistic expectations, not imposing that list of expectations on other people that have their own lives and their own self-perception and their own issues.
Yeah.
So that's what the leadership retreat was all about. And we had, I think we had 29 or 30 register this year. At the end, there were some meetings. I think we had 24 total, but we brought a private chef, which is Chef Charles, amazing guy, because it's at a camp in North Florida. But the idea is that even though the accommodations are modest, we should have great food, great meetings, very good conversations. And so we brought Charles, the chef, Randy Bennett as a facilitator, a guy named Jerry Tejeda, who's a fitness expert that focuses on, accidentally, on executive fitness through body lifting, calisthenics, so no weights required. And I started doing that, was following Jerry, and after a couple of years invited him to kind of like come along to the retreat just to talk to people. Because when we're working as executives and we're traveling, we don't have time for the gym, like a concerted amount of 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And I just found that was just a failure. I was exhausted at the end of the day, or at the beginning of the day, it was just too noisy in the gym. It's too clanky.
Yeah.
There's always the music. There's just bright colors.
You sound like my wife. Yeah. she had a gym membership, and it was just like, here's all the reasons I can't go to this gym. And none of it had to do with the actual exertion of energy.
And when you're in your late 40s or 50s and you're out of shape, it's embarrassing to go to the gym. So I don't want that either. So I started, and at the time we were renovating an old beach cottage. So I just started doing bodylifting. I was like, well, this is approachable and I can do...
You can do it anywhere.
I can do it anywhere. Right. I've got a whole day to do it. So top of the hour, I'm going to do each thing. And that was a system that seemed to work.
Yeah.
And so for executives who want to get into shape and who don't want to go to the gym and be surrounded by Instagram cameras, it's worked for me.
Yeah.
So I brought Jerry along. And I think next year we'll probably have 30 people and it'll pay for itself. It's at this point still kind of meaning versus it's meaning over money.
Yeah.
And then we're aspiring to do a more of a technical roundtable retreat this spring. But that hasn't been kind of all the details.
That's
been
an expansion
yet.
Of this leadership retreat idea. Or
I think it's in parallel to it.
Okay.
Because with a leadership retreat, it's usually subject matter experts who've been elevated into positions of management. And now they're having to deal with millennials and personalities and budgets. And
you've said it
before. They were all just heads down working on their technical wizardry.
Yeah.
How nice is that? You know, it's because no one can touch your technical wizardry.
Right.
They can't question it. But when you become more of an elevated figure and you're in public, it's like in the public figure in a firm, now you're accountable for people's emotions and HR issues and budgets and all of that.
And you said it's much more inwardly focused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this other technical...
The other thing is more, it's more subject matter expertise, but it's really for people that... It's for people that make business decisions, technical decisions, and even if people that make software. So I'd love to get those people together, 40, 50 people for 3 days, 2 days of round tables, and probably a day offsite to kind of decompress and get ready for it. And... talk about what we refer to is, you know, at every conference you see a presentation and then you get that speaker in the corner and go, okay, but tell me the truth. If you've got this kind of situation, what do you do?
Yeah.
And they go, oh yeah, that's kind of tricky. I would have you tried this, and this. So it's the conversations after the presentations that seem to be really valuable. So we're just going to do that. And the intent is to have discussion roundtables around various topics for anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half, create a executive summary, which we'll gather together and make available for download later, but to have the conversations that occur after the presentations.
Yeah.
And it's not a one size fits all. We know in this technology space, we have to bring in disparate tools from disparate software companies and figure out how to wrangle them and get them to work together. And if you're just trying to work blind to figure it out, it's too time consuming and expensive. If you can talk with someone who's done something kind of similar, it'll probably get you on a better path.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be tool specific necessarily.
It isn't. Yeah. 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 I mean, part of it is, but it's three tool specific. Make this work with this and this other thing.
Yeah. And it's situational, right? A lot of it has to do with, well, this is how I've approached that condition or that situation before. And it doesn't have to be software parity specific, but it's like I've experienced that before, and you have the time and the space in a place like that to talk to people about that, right? You don't have to distill it down into a very descriptive paragraph that you throw into the ether, which is aka a forum online, and hope that somebody can decipher it.
Go and find it.
Yeah.
Like just to find the right answer at the right time.
How much time do people spend on that?
And you don't know if it's the right answer. I've searched answers for questions and thought, oh, that's a really, and then scroll to the top and go, what? July 2017. Oh, geez, that's
not going to. It's changed. Yeah.
And things move so fast.
Right.
So the value of getting together and having a multitude of discussions and then even conversations after the conversations, because a lot of us will know each other. So yeah, it's not just for large firms. It's for people that make business decisions, budgeting decisions, technical decisions. I would aspire that the companies that make the softwares that we'll be talking about will be there as well, both to be part of the lessons learned and maybe to listen as well to
understand.
Hear where our stresses are.
And all
be part of that discussion. And good food, good
that
conversations.
Helps. That lubricates the
yeah.
Yeah. So you know, you said earlier one of the most valuable pieces of a conference is the discussion after
the presentation.
And
well, it always works in the presentation, right? When you're showing something off, how to do
always,
a thing.
Almost always, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, almost always. Right.
But the idea of networking and building relationships and kind of this homecoming of professionals that come together at these conferences and get to spend time together is a huge component of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then it's like, let's exchange phone numbers. And that lives beyond that meeting. And that's super important too. It's just to have this network of peers, colleagues in the industry that you can call and say, am I crazy? Right? Like,
well, and when we show you know, the presentations at the conferences, if we're lucky, you know, they all come off without a hitch. But those of us in the subject matter expert space, we know where the bullshit is too. We know where the workarounds are in Revit.
You're reminding me of this that video that Google just published of their new AI thing, and it's like you know, it's this, they call it, what is it, Project, I think it's Gemini or something like that. And they show this whole presentation. And then at the end, I guess in some other channel, they said, we edit it for clarity. We changed a few. And it was like, it just reminded me of that when you said that, because like the presentation is one thing. The reality of it
is something else. Yeah.
Right. And it was more aspirational than realistic or it actually takes longer than we showed it to be. And that's fine at some level if you disclose that. But I think you're right. Like the bullshit meter, it's like, I know how hard that is. It is not like that.
Well, or yes, you could do it this way, but then you will never be able to not do it that way. I find that technical solutions that are implementable aren't good technical solutions. Mm. Like it's okay to have something slightly less automated as long as it's implementable and predictable and flexible. If you create something that's a Gordian knot and it only works if you're plugged into it, but the moment you try to show someone else how to do it, it breaks. That's not a good solution.
Right.
So I think we can get together and have discussions around what would you do if it's not exactly like what would you do in this kind of scenario? And a lot of times I think we just have to choose good technologies. So and the business leaders that make the decisions to purchase the software, they don't always know. They see the end product of something and they go, "Oh, I should buy that." And you go, "Well, if you buy that, you're also going to have to buy a consultant to run it. Do you want your own team to be able to use it? Because maybe there's a tool that doesn't do everything that you see there, but it does most of it, and somebody on your team can use it." So having a discussion that's kind of authentic.
Yeah.
And you got to slow down for that. I mean, our events don't have any alcohol just because it introduces complexity, because we don't also have lanyards. We don't also have, we don't have conferences for the most part on the bodies of large water, right? This conference is on the body of a freshwater lake. And so I can't afford the complexity of people drinking and sinking, to put it lightly.
Right.
Right. And so by not having alcohol, it just removes a bit of complexity. It also allows for this spring event. It'll allow for a family friendly environment. If you want to come and I think we're sort of saying ages 6 to 10, because if both parents are in the AEC space, it's hard to find. Unless you have a relative that lives in the same town, it's hard to find childcare. So we don't just bring them.
Right.
We've got a counselor who will do counselor-led activities in nature and learning for those days. And then in the afternoon and evenings, you come all to dinner. But we're trying to do it in a way that's cost-effective and flexible and enjoyable. And we can't do that at a hotel where we're locked in all day.
Right.
So we'll arrive on a Sunday. On a Monday, we'll have an off-site before the 2 days of roundtables, and then those 2 days of roundtable, and leave on a Thursday.
Yeah,
and keep it very cost effective. It doesn't have to be expensive if you do it right.
Something that's going in my mind is this idea of, I mean, you touched on it a minute ago, but I think it also kind of fits this event, which is like you slow down intentionally, you go slow to go fast.
picking technology that is not just whatever the, like you said, if you just look at the marketing material and you think, oh, it can do all that under perfect conditions, right? That's right, the asterisk.
Right, right. It's like a financial performer who says, right, you know, future conditions may not apply.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. But this idea of authenticity, slowing down, relationships, coming up for
a bit of air.
Yeah.
I don't know the value of technology if it makes you have to rush faster, because I don't think we can rush any faster. I would prefer to let an idea gestate, think about it, meditate on it, and then make a decision and know that decision is going to run itself through a Revit project to move a window, to move a door, to move a piece of furniture, to change something. And when you change it, it's kind of downstream implications taken care of. So, you know, the old yellow legal pad I used to keep through a set of red lines to write things down. If you change something, you had to then go and find out where that was being represented somewhere else. The freeing of that, well, why would I want to rush around and do 5 projects in Revit simultaneously?
Yeah.
If you go slower. Go slower. Don't sometimes rushing to do things. If you rush to do something 3 times, it's not enjoyable, you know, because you've...
The idea of technology was always to free us more time. Like, that was the promise.
Try to turn it off. It's hard. The thing is, in my little lizard brain that I've done to try to do it is that. So grayscale on the phone.
Yeah, so what are we looking at here?
So this is, that's true. No, DC. So you can set up, I've got an iPhone.
Yep.
With accessibility services, you can set up 3 clicks of the power button to set you into grayscale. And for me,
that takes away this, like,
well, after you look at this for a while and then you look at that,
yeah,
with all full color, it looks like a bowl of breakfast. It looks like a bowl of Fruit Loops. You look at that and go, that's not real food. Why are you subjecting yourself to that?
Right.
Whereas I can look at the grayscale and then the rest of the sky vault is what's really interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
Or if I look at it at night because I'm still, you know, the phone's there and it's 2 a.m. and I just happen to wake up. If I read the email, I'm not getting full color sparklies in my brain at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
You're right?
Right.
So I'm just seeing, I don't know. I wonder, I mean, you and I probably both grew up in black and white TV.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, with 3 channels in black and white, after a while, you sort of look up and you look outside and you go, eh, it looks more interesting outside.
Right.
And you would go out and play.
Well, yeah. And now the incentive is to keep
but
you there longer.
Now these colors don't exist in nature.
Right.
And so I don't know that, like, our brain loves these colors. They're flavors that don't exist. And so we're so attracted to these sparkly colors.
Interesting.
And so I'm trying to desensitize myself to getting used to all these bright colors all the time. Like, try to keep it calm.
So what about notifications, like distraction?
Oh, they're all turned off. Except I think so I typically keep the phone in do not disturb mode, but certain people can come through.
Yeah.
Or if you call twice, it might come through.
I think it's
3
times.
I can't, even with a watch, it's always tapping you. You got to turn that off.
Yeah. I have a Garmin watch because I do a lot of outdoor activities and I want to track my cycling tracks and stuff. And I had to turn all of the notifications off completely because it's one thing to have this thing down in my pocket and I can ignore it. But when it's on my wrist too, it was just different.
It's too tempting not to ignore it.
It's right there. I can just flip my wrist and look at it. And I felt like I can never get an Apple Watch. I say that now. But the point is like, I don't...
Yeah. You don't want to be annoyed.
I don't want that.
Yeah. It's too nice. But at the point where you're on a paddleboard and then the phone rings, you're like, I don't want to answer my watch for this. So you have to turn it off.
Yeah.
But then it's hard to turn it off because I think there's something in the brain from way back.
It wants to.
You know, you guys, there's a dinosaur outside. Let's go get it.
Yeah.
Like, what are the dinosaurs and dragons in our existence now? It's constantly being kind of pressured to keep up with the news. It's all things we can't do anything about, but we have strong opinions about. It's like you have to somehow turn it off. So during pandemic, I had to uninstall Facebook.
Yeah.
I just had to take it off the phone because it was people that I love annoying me at 6 a.m.
Right.
So I was like, why am I letting myself
I'm
be
bored.
Annoyed? I should just not look at it. But it's hard not to look at it because you're going to get a little dopamine hit. I think they know to figure out what you like and don't like really quickly. So they only serve that up to you. So the things that annoy you or give you pleasure, are the things that constantly are in your in your space. So you just have to turn it off. So that's part of what the leadership retreat does is, I mean, there's Wi-Fi, there's connectivity. You can still get to your email, but we try to put the phone down and try not to, you know, try not to immediately respond to things. Sometimes, actually, even back in the Revit days, I would try to answer a question right away. And then I realized sometimes that there aren't bad questions, but sometimes the questions are a little unconsidered or maybe a little lazy, like the answers out there. So I started waiting 15 minutes to answer the question or half an hour to answer the question. And then before I could respond, the customer would email, go, oh, I figured it out. And that gives them the freedom and flexibility of going, or either would figure it out and go, I saw this. Is this a good
way? What do you think?
What do you think? Yeah. Instead of just kind of feeding them.
It also changes the expectation about how available you actually are. You and you get to set that expectation to them.
Yeah.
Right. And I think a lot of people are inadvertently setting expectations of themselves from other people's perspectives.
It's hard not to do it.
Yeah.
Like, as a subject matter expert, if I wake up at the 2 a.m. and I see an email and I know that person's in Australia, that's a stressful, all they need is a URL to show them how to do that. I'll answer the question because it just keeps them up to speed. But sometimes
you can't subsidize
a lack of discipline. Like, sometimes the answers are out there, so you can wait a little bit, but waiting is hard.
But through experience, you learn which ones are worth responding to immediately versus over time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think earlier on in your career, it's like you want to show your value, you want to please people, so you're quick to, but then you build that expectation that you're always available and that you have the answers. Architects are often in that position, aren't they? Of having to know the answers and
it's a multitude of things you have to juggle.
And not saying, we'll figure that out, or good question, let me think about that.
I think the artist is afraid if they don't show up and they don't know the answer, that they won't get asked to come along the next time.
Yeah.
And
feast or famine, kind of. It is kind of a evolutionary lizard brain.
It'll be okay.
Response.
Yeah, lizard brain.
Yeah.
This episode is made possible with support from Avail. In a world where precision meets creativity, where every line drawn holds the power to innovate, people like you are shaping the future. But let's face it, in the realm of design, the unknown is your least favorite companion. You've been stranded on the island of inefficient software, lost in the fog of endless searching for the right content. It's time to embark on a new journey, a journey to clarity, efficiency, and design excellence. It's time to get off that island and away from the unknown. Introducing Avail, the beacon in your design odyssey. Say goodbye to the daunting 10 to 20 minutes wasted per search, the costly interruptions in your creative flow. With Avail, your team will zip through content discovery, focusing more on designing and less on searching. Imagine a world where you can stop constantly fighting the costly fires caused by pulling content from past projects, building from scratch, or relying on personal libraries. Avail isn't just a tool, it's a revolution for AECO firms. Organize, manage, and navigate your project information with a leader that's proven in reliability, relatability, and success. Join the ranks of the top AECO firms who've already chosen Avail. In just 30 days, you could deploy Avail and witness a dramatic reduction in costly design errors. Whether it's your first CMS or you're considering a switch, there's someone you should meet. Will Rouse, your guide to all things Avail. Schedule an appointment and explore Avail's capabilities, onboarding programs, and professional services. Don't let your designs be clouded by inefficiency. Clear skies are just a click away. Go to getavail.com/stranded and book a meeting with Will to start your Avail journey today. Avail, where your best design is just a search away. My thanks to Avail for supporting this episode of the Troxel Podcast. And now let's get back to the conversation.
So I think with the leadership retreat is more inward looking. It's more managing self expectations and management of self and others and how you show up. The roundtable, roundtable conference, it's more of discussions with peers and how to come up with an answer that may not be right, but it's on vector.
And you are going to have multiple tracks at that one, right?
Yeah, I think if we have 50, we can't do more than 50 people just to keep it sort of structurally manageable. And then rough math is, well, you have round tables of eight. So you can have up to six simultaneous discussions 4 times a day. And then decompress in the afternoon and come back the next day and do it again.
And you have flexibility maybe to pick different topics as an individual to explore in there? Or is it you pick a track and you're on it?
You know, I don't know. I think ultimately you do whatever's kind of most interesting and best. But for the first pass, we probably have a list of topics from people to choose from.
Yeah.
And we might do a call for topics where people want to facilitate things. But we also might, if we get enough people, just reach out to a few people that we know are coming and who are interested in those things and ask them, would you facilitate this?
Right.
There's nothing due at the end of it except for a 1 to 2 page executive summary. So the point
something
is
to
not,
get it beyond
it's
those
not
50
a 40
people.
Page technical paper that
right.
I would prepare for like an AU presentation in the past. Yeah. So it's discussions, and even the facilitator might show up thinking they know the answer, but the answer is often very contextual.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like if it was real time rendering, how far do you round down the rabbit hole do you want to go? Do you want to use the Unreal Engine because you need a certain end product? Or is Zenscape going to be great for most use cases, but you don't get animated objects? But it's having that discussion. So if we're just subject matter experts, we might know the answers or a variety of answers. But if we also have representatives that make the software, business decision makers who have teams that use the software, they can hear all of this honest discussion.
Yeah.
Yep. And not making it complex in terms of, there's no software sales. There's no exhibition. There's no lanyards. And it's mid North Central Florida at the beginning of May will be 85 degrees during the day. So it's not too hot, and 65 at night. So it's not too cold. And we'll be outdoors a lot.
Yeah.
It's not being locked in a conference hotel for a couple of days.
Right.
So hopefully that also draws people in because they enjoy that kind of environment.
Or if they don't know they enjoy that kind of environment because they're in the cube or in their office so much, it'll give them a different experience of what a conference could be.
I hope so, because we all, you know, those of us who go to these conferences a lot, we enjoy that. We enjoy the high impact artifact of the loud music and the flashing lights. And then other times we like, I just need to decompress a bit.
Right.
And so this is more of the decompressed version, or sort of we're calling it in sort of a metaphor terms, AEC acoustics, because it's the acoustic version of the rock and roll event. And or you could say, you know, BIM unplugged or AEC unplugged. It's that quieter conversation after the presentation where you go, okay, tell me the truth. Is that really going to work on this kind of situation? And if it doesn't, point me in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any, you know, there is not a lot of that in the AEC space. And I think as we elevate in our careers and we get older and we get more experienced, we need these kinds of conversations. We don't just need technical presentations.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think introspection, it's still introspection at some level, right? It's directly applied to what you do at your day job potentially, right? So less on the what you do after hours between work days and more. Mm. But still at a personal, in a very personal level of talking to other people who are...
Well, like even at AU, I know there's 50 people that I really want to see.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of strangers in the crowd.
Right.
But I'll go because I'm going to see something interesting, have an interesting conversation, but I'm also going to be able to duck away to Starbucks and have a chat with someone, you know, off the show floor, away from the noise. And so there's still value with that. But I can't have conversations about all the various technologies that we use because that's their party.
Yeah.
And that's how it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested what you think. So I guess we'll change subjects here because I think I read something that you had written about BIM. Imagine that. But the idea of what do you think is the biggest thing holding us back as an industry? Because there's this, if we rewind or step back a little bit and think about the we talked about this a minute ago, the true potential of what it could do. And then
you mean in terms of the technology?
In terms of the technology and just the evolution of the practice. We spend a lot more time on projects now than I feel like we ever have before, because buildings are more complex. The software that we use to draw them and model them is a lot more complex.
Yeah, rightfully complex. I mean,
agencies are more complex to deal with, bureaucracy. Organizations are more complex now. We have a lot more positions in organizations to deal with. And the bigger the organization, the more positions there are, and HR and all. But the thing that really, I guess I won't bury the lead here, but people are difficult. And you talked about this with this leadership retreat. Like, I don't necessarily have the
skills. Yeah, I'm not difficult. Other people are difficult.
Yeah, right. It's always them.
It's always them.
But this idea of adoption versus innovation, right? Adoption. I'm curious to hear what you think about that productivity chart that we've all seen that McKinsey graph that's in everybody's presentation who's outside the industry that shows construction being way down here for the last 50 years and everything else going up like a rocket. And I don't feel that in our industry, but
I think people talk about, okay, I don't want to sound jaded, but there are a lot of technologies that kind of become flash in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
And they become buzzwords, and AI in that sense is a buzzword right now. I think once we realize it's just the carbon-based architectural intern, it's not that big of a deal. I don't know that we're really held back. I think it's just incredibly complicated logistically to build buildings.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter how far you rush ahead. During the pandemic, this beach cottage, which is only a little cottage on the coast of North Carolina, try getting plywood because the additive to the glue that they use to make plywood isn't available. So now you have to go, okay, well, what else can we work on? Because I don't want people leaving the project.
They won't come back.
Yeah, they might be on something else, and then the logistics get more complicated. So I don't know how much faster, in a way, how much more efficient we can do it. And there, I was... this idea that, if we only do pre-manufacturing of a building, then it won't, that'll make it hyper-efficient because of all the waste that occurs on site.
Yeah.
Contractors are not incentivized to waste. They want to build the building and get off the project just as fast as the owner does. So I don't know that the butterfly flapping his wings in the manufacturing space is going to solve the problem, because creating problems that are hyper efficient but inflexible creates other problems.
Mm.
It's a logistics Gordian knot. And
explain what a Gordian knot is, because this is the second time you've said that.
Yeah, the Gordian knot of the idea that you have this I think it's a Greek parable. There's this knot of rope, and he's trying to ask people test their wisdom. How would you untie this knot? And the king takes his sword and cuts the knot in half. So the Gordian knot is this, you've gotten to this point of irrecoverable complexity.
Mm.
I don't know how you could make it less complex.
Mm.
Maybe at the domestic level, you can make it less complex if you hyper-centralized utility in the residence, where it's, you're connected to utility for houses, right? Electrical production, water, cleaning water, how you treat water, all of that kind of stuff. There's technologies to capture water, to treat waste, and kind of centralize all of this from a technical aspect.
Right.
But at the commercial aspect, I don't know that there's a way right now. I don't know that we're seeing that. There's a lot of stuff on LinkedIn. The hotel in China that gets built in a day.
Right.
Well,
or a hospital.
Or a hospital.
Yeah.
Or an apartment complex. But do people aspire to live in complex in apartment buildings that can be built in a week? I even would use them. If we could. So let's go to the extreme of efficiency and imagine a system where the client could want a building today and tomorrow that building would exist. Would we do that? And I don't think we would, because on the third day, the client would go, you know what? Market forces have changed and we need more unit B and less unit A. Keep the unit C's about where they were. And now you've done something so quickly that it was inflexible and it couldn't respond to market demands, which you would have learned had the project occurred over 18 months. So there's just the ability to do things efficiently while still allowing for flexibility is just part of the it's part of the design to construction process.
And just the ideal or the idea behind what the value of design is tends to go away in that equation, right? Because customization, unique things that, you know, my life is different than your life and I need different things than you do. My family's like this, yours is like that. It's very hard to solve for all of those variables with a common output, right? And even in the example of a hospital in a day, you can't tell me that the design process didn't get a hell of a lot longer.
Oh, or maybe the hospital doesn't accommodate the next medical emergency because it was done quickly. It wasn't flexible. Like trying to predict how something is going to be used is really tough.
Yeah.
And in the construction, or let's say in the manufacturing space, most things that are manufactured are able to leave the utility of where they're manufactured. So there's ships and airplanes and submarines and cars. They all leave under their own power. Whereas buildings, hard to do that with buildings. So there's all of this efficiency that occurs, well, allegedly, by building something and then transporting it to the site. But when you do that, you ship a lot of air. On the other hand, and you risk things breaking under transport, and now you have to repair them. As opposed to the present system, which is get all of the pieces and parts together in bundles as tight as possible and ship those to the site and then get people to assemble them.
Yeah.
So it's still manufacturing.
Right.
I don't know how we could do it any more efficiently than we're doing it now. And certainly other places do it better. Like if you look at construction in Singapore or construction in Germany, like the way people are showing up to the site, there's head, eye protection, ear protection, foot protection. I see a lot of construction out on the coast that's maybe not all OSHA compliant.
People are
just, no.
Southern Oregon, it's like that as well.
People up on roofs without proper safety measures.
Yeah.
So I don't know that we're doing it. I think we're doing it as least inefficiently as possible because
I like that.
because economies, because otherwise you're wasting money. And so it's always measured in terms of, are you going to waste money?
Right.
And if you try to figure out everything, I think it overwhelms a customer. Even if you could say, pick your house, pick your fittings, pick your furnishings, and then that's going to get delivered to the site, as opposed to the flexibility and the serendipity of going, oh my gosh, that window from this location and that view, we need to move the window over 2 feet. Can you guys reframe that? It's like, yeah, you'll love it.
Have you ever designed like that before? Have you worked like that before?
So on the cottage, I'd never, in all of my career, I've never done my own project. And then during the pandemic, was able to design my own project for the first time.
Yeah.
And experience the serendipity of going, oh my gosh, that's an incredible opportunity. We should take advantage of it. And we even had Revit and we had Enscape and I could see where the sun was setting on my birthday. Like all of this stuff was amazing. But then you actually get into the space and...
You're always designing, right?
You're always thinking about it. You're inhabiting it.
Right.
And
you learn as you go. You can't not learn as you go because you see opportunities that weren't...
You didn't know it was there.
Right, you didn't know.
So the builder that I worked with was, one of the builders that I worked with is an immigrant from El Salvador, amazing guy, Omar Flores. And he did the kitchen in Charlotte, and he has very careful attention to detail. And just amazing guy to get to know him. So he comes out to the coast, and I said, look, I don't want to do the walls in jib board. I want to use half-inch maple for all the walls, except for like the wet walls and baths, right? And instead of the half inch maple ply abutting it, I want to leave a gap and I want the gap to be about a quarter wide, like a coin. So just leave a gap. The first time we start putting these panels up and Omar comes and goes, hey, look at this. And he's got a panel up with a quarter in it. The quarter is being pinched by the two panels. And he's got another panel up with a dime. And he goes, I think a quarter is too much. I think we should do a dime. The guy was right.
Yeah.
And these kinds of things happened all along the way.
Right.
That I thought I had it figured out, but it wasn't. Or I thought I had it figured out, but old houses settle. And this is like a 30, 40-year-old cottage that
nothing's
we were renovating.
Square, nothing's flat. Nothing's
and so we
straight.
Had to come up with a method to accommodate how the house had settled.
Yeah.
And I thought I had it figured out going into it, but that was perfect where everything was
latex
plumb
cock,
and square.
Phil, that's the
latex. No, we did. So it's I call it a reverse crown.
Okay.
We put a strip of ply at the top where the ceiling was to take up, right? And then a strip of ply at the bottom, same material, and then three strips centered. And the ply would attach to that. So at that point, we were no longer dependent
on the
locations of the studs to place the plywood, so things could be lined up nicely. And the other artifact was that reverse crown creates an art rail. So
you can hang things wherever you want.
I don't have to.
Without
I'm not putting
holes.
A screw in the wall.
Yeah, no holes.
Yeah. So you get these art cables and you hang things with that.
You can't patch that very easily.
No.
It's no spackle.
And Omar
for
was always looking for opportunities. Like he would get the metaphor of how we want to be careful about how things align and where they align. And then he would go, I know what you're trying to do here, but what if we do this? And I'll go, oh my gosh, Omar, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought I had it figured out.
Design
and even then.
Go.
Yep. Just be ahead of the design. We were able to add a third level that didn't exist because we added decks to the south side that didn't exist and a deeper deck on the north side that did. It was only like 7 feet. And when we did that, I realized it creates a greater roof volume. So instead of storage, it's now the executive level. And I think it was on a FaceTime call to Justine over video, kind of it's like the sun sets and I'm up on the roof and she goes, oh, this is a really nice view. We should have another deck up here. And I thought, oh, no, we don't need another deck. We got all these decks out there. So, but I said, okay, well, what if we just take the center structural bay and just make a smaller deck? So it's like 10 feet wide.
The crow's nest.
Yeah. And it's, we call it, executive lounge. And from that level, you can't see it from the street and you get up there and you can see the sunrise and sunset. And it was an accident that I hadn't designed going in because I thought we've got enough decks. But that area, that's a nice reveal at the top. And it was all the serendipity of going slow.
Yeah.
It was being able to take advantage of that opportunity. Whereas if you design it somewhere else and it comes and it gets plonked down on the site, you don't have time to take advantage of those happy accidents.
And being involved in that process is a key piece.
Oh, right? It's incredibly stressful and I hated it.
But at the same time, that wouldn't have happened if you didn't, right?
No. It would have been more stressful. I lived in the house during reconstruction. The alternative was coming
too.
On Friday
and
realize plugs are all
in the wrong place.
And this is five inches off. But what does it matter? It's only 5 inches. I would have been mental. But living in it was stressful, but that was the lesser bad way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then also going to sleep and thinking about what happened has to be done the next day and kind of just playing the mental math, not even doing it in Revit, just like think about it, and then do it.
Right.
Yep.
Measure three times, cut once. I've done a kitchen like that and I lived there at the same time too. So I was cooking in the garage on the camp stove while we were remodeling the kitchen or cooking on the barbecue outside or whatever. But building a soffit over this really weirdly shaped kitchen island that I did, because I tore out a bunch of walls, put a stainless-looking stainless steel. It was steel that I just spun to look like stainless, and then clear-coated it to hold up a beam that took the place of those walls. And then I had this island that kind of like jogged around that. So they were separate. And then I was like, huh, well, I want to build a soffit over this. And I didn't draw any of this. I mocked it up with furring strips.
Right.
As I went. And I would, nope, this needs to be a little bit wider here, a little bit narrow here. I'm going to cut this off here. And just treating it like a study model in the real space at full scale, in the moment, and making those decisions then afforded design. And I don't know, it was an incredible freeing way to work as an architect who was trained to like figure it all out ahead of time. Right.
Yeah, under the punishment of being liable for things that you have to so much foreknowledge of how something's going to work.
Right.
How stressful is that?
Yeah.
So I don't know how.
How do you get back to that master builder? Like that's kind of what you're talking about, right? Because a sheet set for, I don't know, like pick a Frank Lloyd Wright project, right? Like Unity Temple. It was like 11 sheets.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of stuff is figured out in the moment by someone who knows.
And
I don't know that we have to get to master builder.
Builder.
I think it's a nice metaphor, but I don't know that Frank Wright actually ever wanted to work construction. He hired the right people to do it.
He wanted to be out there and he wanted to tell people how to do it, though.
Yeah.
Right? Because
and that part of it, of being able to have the conversation,
realized is
Because the person building it is focused on, does it function to such an extreme detail that sometimes, well, why don't we just move that over a couple of inches? Well, why would you do that? Because of this. Oh, that'll look great. So someone who's thinking about, you know, the macro to micro.
Right.
I don't know that we have the freedom to do that on commercial projects.
Yeah,
That's what did they ask when they started the dome in Florence, Brunelleschi's dome? In that book, they started the proportion of the cathedral not knowing how they were going to build the dome. And that's an expensive mistake because once those proportions are set, everything else is derived. And their response was, well, when it's time, God will help us figure it out. I don't know that we could build football stadiums like that. Oh,
right.
We'll figure out that
trust.
Roof.
Just trust.
We'll figure out the trust. Trusses later. Yeah, God will help us figure it out. No, you'll go to prison. So I don't know that we can do it any more efficiently.
Yeah.
Which makes it hard. But I think what we can learn to do is when the contractor is yelling the F word on a Monday morning and you're a part of that conversation, you learn to detach and not take it personal. And that helps the contractor sit down or settle down. Because even that's first thing out. That's just a language modifier when things aren't going right.
Right.
But you can get wound up and get frustrated, and then that's not fun.
Yeah.
But if you can learn a proper method of quiet confidence that gives a client confidence, go, yeah, this is going to happen.
And this is kind of an ethos of that leadership conference, right?
Yeah.
It's like learning how to react in situations where you're not in control, or just being able to control your reaction is a key component to leadership.
It doesn't mean you know the right answer.
Yeah.
There's Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, which were his private journals of Stoicism that weren't meant to be for public consumption, but after he passed, they were published. I still refer to them regularly. I just keep it there all the time, and I'll read a couple pages and put it back down again. Because he was, his experiences from being a Roman general to being effectively the Caesar.
Right.
And having to deal with annoying people that were always trying to come and get an angle. Like, he just talks about it in such modern terms of people annoying him
Timeless,
all the time. And things are annoying him, and
right. He
can't manage and predict things. And I think maybe earlier in my career, I was more of the mindset that if I could just predict what could possibly go wrong, it would help me relax because I had figured it out ahead of time. And then you realize it's just too complex. It's better just to let it go and engage a team of smart people who might not do it the way you do it, but hey, if it doesn't work out, we'll do it a different way. And that's a better way to approach it. It's hard as a subject matter expert to do that because, to your point, you want to rush and give the answer quickly.
Yeah. Right.
But after a while, things are too complex and you just have to find the right people to work with. And it's more interesting.
Yeah.
This episode is made possible with support from Confluence. Picture this: October 2019, Lexington, Kentucky, the birthplace of Confluence, a place where tech leaders, AEC product developers, and practitioners came together for three transformative days. It was more than a conference. It was a confluence of ideas, discussions, and unforgettable social experiences. Since then, over 200 attendees have experienced the magic of Confluence. I've had the privilege of being part of three of these remarkable gatherings, two in Kentucky and one in Orange County, each one a melting pot of learning, collaboration, and camaraderie around a topic shaping our industry. And now we're thrilled to announce the next regional Confluence event in April 2024, in the vibrant heart of New York City. This time, we dive deep into the realms of AI and machine learning, unraveling their mysteries and potentials in our industry. Are you interested in being part of this exciting journey? To continue the conversation? To shape the future? Visit the link in the show notes for more details. Confluence, where ideas flow, connections form, and the future of AEC technology is shaped, one conversation at a time. My thanks to Confluence for supporting this episode of the Troxel Podcast. And now, let's get back to the conversation.
What is something that you've either added to your life or removed that has had a huge impact?
It's usually taking away. It's usually being in a position of being able to more and more and more say no to things that aren't interesting. And I used to do investment. I used to do a lot more investment advising for technology companies. And the hourly rate compared to what I would have made in an hour when I was in architecture school working for a civil firm was like a multitude more per hour. But I say no to it now because it's not worth it. I'd rather... I look at it this way. Anytime you're going to spend time doing something, imagine you had to pay your hourly rate to do it. And if you wouldn't, then don't do it. So I don't watch TV anymore. That's probably something that I've just accept. I will indulge in South Park and Rick and Morty. It may be a couple of things, but it's deliberate. I don't just turn it on for the noise.
Mm-hmm.
I turn off the TV. I probably don't have music playing in the background by choice. It's a lot more quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to get comfortable in that kind of space because you end up getting in your own head and you end up thinking about uncomfortable things because you're not distracted. But on the long term, I think it's better. So what I've taken out is I don't watch TV. I read a lot more books. I don't listen to music. I don't watch the news anymore. And that was just a series of probably in the last 10 years. The news was just irrecoverably annoying.
Yeah.
And now that I've, you know, when you're in airports and places where you have to watch screens, you notice, I notice now that on these, like particularly in news, there's always a background that's moving. It's hypercolor. The way that American news channels present news, once you turn the TV down, watch the eyebrows of the presenters, and it's very exaggerated. The eyebrows are always moving. The facial affect is always moving.
It's an act. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the way to attract your attention.
Right.
You know, from emergency through commercial break to the next emergency.
Right.
And then I realize I just can't do anything about that. And I think it's overwhelming our sense of empathy. So as humans, we're empathetic people, and we understand, you know, death and tragedy and all of this, but it's just constant now. And so what it does is I think it overwhelms our sense of empathy that we feel that we have to do something about it, but we really can't. But it's happening in our living room. Why aren't you doing something about it? And so it's hijacking our empathy. And so turning off the news, I still skim the news, but I skim the headlines. Or turning off the news, turning off the radio, turning off the TV, and just trying to be in a more quiet place. Even though it's uncomfortable, I still haven't. I talked with Randy last time about this at the leadership retreat because he always asks me, are you happy? And I always say, Randy, happiness is indulgent. We have to get our shit done. Who gets happiness? And Omar, the guy I was working with, the builder, I asked him what he aspired for his daughters to do when they got older. And I was thinking like lawyer, you know, architect, engineer, what do you want them to do? And he said, I want them to be happy.
Yeah.
So I haven't nutted that out, Evan, this idea of being happy.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes we just have to find something to sustain us between periods of grief.
Mm, yeah. Keep yourself busy.
Yeah. You know, as we get older and you have friends that pass and you have parents
and
that
you have pain
pass,
that you never had before.
And you have things that you can't control.
All of this stuff.
So kind of just... We just have to
A coping mechanism, yeah.
Yeah, we just have to quietly find something to sustain us between periods of tragedy. And maybe that's my best happiness, kind of.
That's interesting.
It's the small things.
Yeah.
The thing that I aspire to now would be a good meal with friends.
Yeah.
That's like whether I do the cooking less, I'd probably eat out a lot less because during pandemic, you're sort of learning to cook. Everything's online. You want to cook amazing steak?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's there.
It's there. Amazing chicken, like amazing whatever you want to cook. There's amazing recipes. And so being able to have an artifact where you're actually preparing a meal with friends is, that's an uncommon pleasure.
Yeah.
So those kind of quieter moments, instead of just going to a restaurant, standing in line, getting your table, getting your drink order. Kids next to you, like rolling his truck through his vegetables. He's got a car at the table. It's all that noise. And then an hour later, you've eaten and you've tipped and you've had dessert. And like, I don't know if I was actually able to relax. So meals with friends.
Yeah.
Quiet.
Yeah.
And quiet is probably, as we were talking before, quiet's probably a luxury.
Right.
Yep.
Nowadays.
Yeah. I think about it in terms of, you know, it used to, not that long ago, people would have been able to just exist without a lot of noise.
Right.
Because music was something that you had to go and listen to live, or you either had to play. There was no recordings, but now we can have recordings of conversations, recordings of theater productions. It's television, radio. I don't know that we're evolved yet for all of this constant constant hum.
Yeah. I was just watching this recorded live stream of one of my favorite YouTubers yesterday. His name's Rick Beato, and he's a musician. He's a producer, a music producer. And he has a series on his channel called What Makes This Song Great, where he breaks down all the tracks, and he's a theorist. He knows music.
Yeah.
And he can tell you why that song is great from a technical point of view, but it's not what the artist was thinking when they made that song, right? And so he's weaving these together and letting you hear things that you've never heard in a song
before. Pointing something.
That you will never not hear the next time you hear that song. And the live stream was on 90s music. So this is my thing, right? This is when my coming of age was, you know, during the 90s. And it was very much a time when, especially as he went through this playlist that he literally made in like 5 minutes. And it was probably 60 or 70 songs on it that he just threw into a playlist and started playing them and saying, this one, this one, this one. These were all great songs. And at some point, music stopped being that good. And I'm just generalizing right now because
I don't think you're being cynical. I would agree.
You could pick any decade, probably. And especially when it was formative for you, like that's your decade, right? But
I would add it became less when they stopped playing their own instruments, when it became a performance and they weren't playing their own instruments.
Well,
that's when it kind of flipped.
He asked the question. He said, when did we stop listening to music with our ears? And I thought that was so insightful, right? And you said the screens aren't going away.
Right.
The news, music is a video, it's a production, it's a performance, it's visual and audio, right? It's like, I thought that was just so insightful. And it was a live chat because it was a live stream and people are throwing on there like what it was auto-tune. It was people not playing their own instruments. It was producers writing songs for artists that were then performing those. It was the phone. It was the iPod. It was Napster. And there was a lot of things that all, I think, play into this idea of being overwhelmed by media and not actually, like you remember the good old days of having listening rooms and having listening parties and listening to your hi-fi and putting on your headphones and just like my dad sitting in a room listening to a record play, the whole thing all the way through.
I don't know that.
It's interesting.
And I think those recordings, I don't think they're music. I think the music is the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up around Athens, Georgia in the 80s and 90s. So going to downtown Athens, scrubbing through
the
flagpole, picking, probably going to the downstairs, which was a little club at that time, or going to the Rockfish Palace and seeing a band. As a matter of fact, one of Rick's, one of his presentations is talking about a guy named Rob Aldridge. If you go back and find that, because Rob and they had a band called Holly Faith, and he was an extraordinary songwriter and musician. They never quite got the trajectory, but beautiful songwriting. But you would go and see it. And I remember driving down, getting something to eat, standing in line, getting into the club.
Experience.
You feel the music. You anticipate it. Where now it's not, that's like it's so immediate. It's a recording. It's something that you hear. It's not something that you feel. And so I'm a big advocate of going to see live music. If you ever get it, I don't know if it would come to Medford. The best live performance I've seen in a long time was the Book of Mormon on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Amazing production.
Yeah.
I can listen to it on CD. It's the recording, but it's not like the experience of it. Oh, my gosh. Amazing. Live music.
Yeah.
And so we should, you know, as a best practice, get back to more of that. It's hard now. I mean, the big, you know, the performers that you aspire to go and see, it can be thousands of dollars for a ticket. But live music in small towns, that's pretty good.
But don't you think this applies to architecture? Like, there is this immense pressure to become more and more efficient and productive and go faster and change things. And then there's this theme that we're talking about, which is like, what is it really about?
But what about the acoustic version of architecture?
What about the experience of the architect and the client together in the process and building the thing?
I think it's an artifact of how architects, you know, even 20 years ago, if you wanted to design, I don't think it's a coincidence that the companies that designed football stadiums grew up in the Midwest. So you're talking about Kansas City,
yeah.
HNTB, HOK, those firms.
Populous, yeah.
Yep. Well, later Populous, but they had to be in a place because all your designers are co-located and they all had these big drafting boards. So you need space that's not expensive. If you're going to design a football stadium, that's where you go do it. Now, that artifact of big spaces to design buildings still exists. I don't think it's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But the big firms are such that they're compressed under their own weight. And the revenue per employee, I don't know, maybe once you get to 30 people, you start having middle management, but now you have to pay for positions that don't generate revenue. So now you have to grow again,
right?
Which creates more middle management, and then it's irrecoverable. So I don't know how firms grow without proportionally, you don't want to proportionally grow the complexity or the complexity.
Yeah.
Because at the point where you start having to have HR meetings to discuss issues that are irrecoverable, then that's not billable work. It's not necessarily in value to the customer. So I think long-term, how these large companies are going to survive, unless they bring some kind of unique and particular value that only large firms. So you've seen this, right? The large companies buying other large companies,
right.
And there's been consolidation in the last 10 years, but they have to have very particular industry expertise to survive. If you want to build a football stadium, you're kind of limited, but for a lot of commercial projects, do you need office space? Do you need the complexity, or are large firms a lot of small teams, and those small teams don't need large firms anymore?
Right. It does seem like you're advocating for small, nimble teams who have the ability to say no, but leverage technology to do big things. Like that.
As long as you have the customer's confidence, right? I mean, why would you, if I was a customer wanting to design a building and kept getting voicemail every time I wanted to talk to the project manager, I would get frustrated.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know that the artifact to create a large commercial project requires that you have an office space full of people that are co-located and they have desks. I mean, the space we park our cars in are larger than the space that we have to work in, right? Our cubicles, our 8x10 cubicles are half the size of our 10x20 parking spaces.
Right.
So I don't know. I think we have to come together and have meetings like we're doing today. We could have done this over a Zoom meeting or something, but it's not as enjoyable. So you need to come together sometime and have that compression. But then a lot of it is just let me be quiet. And when I need to speak to people, I'll speak to them. We don't have the Well, maybe the pandemic taught us a bit about that. You know, the value of being able to be quiet and work in a concentrated way and then come together as you need to.
So you talked about that idea of removing things, improving the quality of life. And you also talked about having to, you know, deal with your own thoughts. So I'm just wondering, overall, net positive, but in what way for you?
Ooh, well, over the last, I would say the last 5 to 10 years of turning off the TV, turning off the radio, saying no to things, it feels very indulgent. Because I've got friends that still go into the office and they're showing up before the sun rises and they're leaving after the sun sets. And that's the decisions that they've made.
Yeah.
But I just didn't want to make decisions that you couldn't. I don't like irrecoverable complexity. So if you make a decision that you can't back out of, realizing that it's too complex, you have to be careful about those kinds of things. So if you want to work for a great company, good. But if you work for that great company and then buy a house that's a little too expensive and a car that's a little too new, now you can't say no.
Right.
And it's very stressful if you show up Monday and you're told that your position's been eliminated.
Yeah.
So the freedom of not having that worry is For me, I prefer that more. The freedom and flexibility to be curious so that when something interesting comes along, if I had seen Enscape working for a company, I could have bought it and used it, but I wouldn't have had the experience of actually helping those guys go to market and seeing the company grow from, you know, at the time, I think we were 8 to 10 people to now Chaos is probably 800 people.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't know that I would be good at, I'm good at being part of it and helping to curate it and direct it. I'm not good at being an employee of that or an employer. And I, of 800 people, I don't know if I could manage the,
I heard yeah. Jensen Huang recently say that if he was going to do it all again, he wouldn't, because it's been so difficult, so difficult, harder than he could have ever imagined to do something like NVIDIA.
Yeah. So if you do that, once you say yes, you can't say no. Mm-hmm. A lot of people depend on you. So you have to be careful what you say yes to. There's one of the first engineers I worked for coming back. I lived in New Zealand for a while and came back and worked for a guy named Boney Dawood with Dawood Engineering. He's still the sole owner, probably plus 200 people. Maybe they were 300 at a time. And he was one of the, we had a roundtable discussion a fireside chat with him at the leadership retreat to talk about how he grew his company. And I even had a follow-up conversation. How do you grow the company without growing the complexity? And he admitted that that part's hard. You have to choose the right people, because ultimately what you do is you're only managing 10 people and everybody's managing 10 people. And that allows you to manage complexity. So he has a team of 10 people that he trusts, and they manage groups of each of those manage 10 people, and then that scales. But I wouldn't want to be involved in a situation. I'm fortunate in that I have the freedom that I could say no. If a company wanted to hire me to pay me more money, I don't think I'd do it, Evan, because at that point, they own you. You can't say no to other things that might be interesting. You're not being paid to be curious at that point.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when I left Autodesk to go to work for the large A&E firm, one of the first meetings I had with a senior executive, as I sort of laid out the strategy, which I thought was a strategy for the quarter, and he said, that's a good strategy for the year. Okay.
Slow down.
Wow. That really surprised me. I thought, well, what am I going to do here that's valuable? But the other thing is I said, well, you know, is there anything I didn't mention that you need from me? And they said, we don't want you talking at conferences anymore or sharing anything we learn. Like, that's just for us. And for me, that of being able to kind of discover something useful and share it with people was very important to me. It's kind of where I'm wired. And being told that I couldn't do that, I just had to say, well, I guess I can't do that anymore. And it was dispiriting.
I know exactly what that's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like it's weird nowadays with social media and followers and audiences.
Yeah.
And
what can you talk about? What can't you talk about?
And all of a sudden it just becomes this weird nightmare of management of, I can't be me anymore. Right. I am now, like you said, owned by that entity.
And that's what you sign up for.
Right.
They own you 24 hours a day. And so if you say yes to that, just go in wise, you know, with eyes wide open.
Right.
Or don't, and go lean and work on the projects that you care about. And I don't know that you necessarily won't make as much money, but you'll have a lot more left over. And what I found was making the most money that I'd ever made working for a company, I never enjoyed it. Even when I was on vacation, because I knew at the end of 2 weeks I had to go back to the thing that I didn't enjoy.
Right.
And so that was a very dispiriting kind of experience. And I'm wired to not give up. So even though I felt like I should have called my old director back at Autodesk and said, hey, I got to be honest. I think I've made a bad decision here. I'm not good at managing people, but I didn't know how to do that. And I didn't know how to quit, or I didn't, it felt like quitting if I stopped doing it. So I didn't know, I was being very binary about it. And so I think the hard part is, as subject matter experts, going back to the original thing, is like, we get really good at something, you get recognized, you save the company a bunch of time and money. Oh, you should manage a team. Oh, yeah, that sounds great. I'll get paid more money. And then now it's like, oh my gosh, I'm managing a team. I really miss the thing I used to do. So being told flat out, we don't want you speaking at conferences anymore. You don't write any more technical best practice articles. Everything you learn, we're only going to share internally. And it just kind of went, it just kind of a flame went out.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, you're paying me a lot of money. I guess that's what you have to do.
When
you,
the trade-off.
It's adulting.
Yeah.
That's right. What you do.
Right.
And yeah, so I probably learned a bit hard, you know, learned from bad lessons. The good thing with bad lessons is that you pay attention.
Bad lessons.
You're hyper attentive to the bad thing happening.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're kind of wired for that too.
But I don't think that a young, you know, going back to the, you know, the initial bookend of a young person that wants to be an architect now, if you go to the expensive school, it's probably because you aspire to the status of going to the school and then working for the high profile firm. But if you don't aspire to that, if you want to have interesting customers and do interesting work that no one has ever heard about,
yeah,
you'll do really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. You can make a decent living being an architect.
Oh, yeah. Looking after, just solving the customer's problems. Give them a good experience. There's a guy in New Zealand named Val McQuarrie. And I don't think anyone listening has ever heard of him. Go look up Val McQuarrie in New Zealand. He's won House of the Year multiple years. He does incredibly precious work. And he uses a bit of SketchUp, a bit of Revit, a bit of Enscape. Lives on an island off the coast of Auckland. You have to get back and forth by ferry. Incredibly approachable, interesting guy. And he doesn't need the overhead. And customers are coming to him now, but he said no to a lot of things.
That was the sacrifice.
That was a sacrifice. You say no to the upfront, fancy firm, fancy paycheck, but you kind of, you get to hold on to your freedom a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And that's the, I think that's the long term. Ultimately, what I was trying to do was find a job or find a path where I could do it my whole life. And I think in that way I did, you know, architecture and technology and not saying yes to everything, being careful about what you say yes to because you can't, you often can't go back.
Living with intention.
Well, I didn't know it at the time.
Accidentally.
Saying no to things. Yeah, just saying no to, you know, the new car is great. New cars should have 3-day waiting periods. You know, you go back. Don't buying the new car. Don't make decisions that you can't get out of. And the new car locks you down, you know. If I borrowed money to go to school and if I bought a new car and I had other debt, I would have never been able to say yes to taking a chance with this little company in, you know, Waltham called Revit Technology. I'd be an architect in Charlotte, which is noble. But I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have had the experience of hopping on a plane to come to Denver to chat with you.
Right.
To fly back, you know, to be curious.
Right.
Yeah.
Fun adventure.
Yeah.
It's been a fantastic conversation. I feel like there's a lot of wisdom, shared wisdom in this one.
Well, you've had a lot of this experience too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, part of it is a shared experience that you didn't know you were sharing. And that's important to capture, I think, because there's so much in there that other people can glean from. I hesitate to say learn from. It's our experience, right? It may not be.
Well, I think you and I both said no to certain things or we were told no, right? So we had to figure something else out.
Right.
But once you learn to say no a little bit and you find the sun still comes up the next morning,
right.
I think I'll say no again.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon you're at a point where you can say yes to really what you care about and be hyper-focused. And it's freeing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great place to put a cap on this one.
Okay.
Yeah. This has been an incredible adventure, flying and meeting in the middle of the country for a day to record a conversation and then to go home. And I hope people enjoyed it as much as I did because I got a lot out of it. This has been great.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks to our sponsors and thanks to our members this week. Find out how you can become a member at trxl.co, and I'll talk to you again next week.